important ones. Quickly, we're moving on to issue two, which is agenda reference 23. And Stuart, I think, is going to give us an overview of this.
Thank you, Ian. IFRS 15 mandates capitalising the incremental cost of obtaining a contract subject to recoverability on a practical expedient and amortising these costs over the contract period. However, IFRS 15 is a revenue standard, and this has two important implications. Firstly, there may be interactions with other standards that deal with recognition of liabilities. And secondly, IFRS 15 does not give detailed guidance on cost accounting. Accordingly, there are seven implementation issues that have come up and that we have put for discussion by the TRG members. The staff considers that six of these issues are relatively straightforward. They are capitalising and amortising initial and renewal commissions, commissions on modifications, commissions contingent on future events, commissions subject to clawback, whether to capitalise fringe benefits, and lastly, amortisation of contract assets on multiple performance obligations. One issue is less straightforward, and we draw this one to the TRG's attention. That issue is issue 5, commissions subject to a threshold. And the point that gives rise perhaps to slightly more ambiguity is that in IFRS 15, the general unit of account is the contract. However, where there's a threshold, the link between an individual commission and individual contracts is more blurred. However, the staff do consider, for the reasons in the paper, that there's sufficient guidance in the standard so that it can be applied to all these issues in a manner consistent with the board's intention. There's no point rehearsing further what's in the paper, and so we welcome your observations and comments.
Okay, well, we'll start here in London. The assertion's been made that the standard covers the situation. Do we have any views that disagree with that, or some part of that?
More a confirmation than a disagreement. There are quite a few different examples that Stuart was characterising as being straightforward, and I wondered if it was helpful to try and identify what might be the common features or principles that are underlying. And it did seem to me that in terms of identifying costs that will be capitalised, notably in examples 1, 3 and 4, there's quite a helpful linkage implicit in the paper with step 1 of the model. So you look at the period of the contract that gets into the model, you look at the related obligations, and that's telling you what to capitalise. Conversely, when you come to amortise, you're looking at the pattern of transfer that may potentially stretch to anticipated future contracts. Because I have to say, there are a lot of questions around the place with lots and lots of different fact patterns, so pulling out what seem to be the common features that drive the scenarios that we perhaps are going to think are straightforward, that's quite helpful. In terms of the more difficult questions, the arrangements where there is a threshold, those of us who've had the immense pleasure of working with IFRIC 21 over the last year or two have had lots of questions about thresholds and when you have a liability, and with a particular focus on interim financial statements. And I wonder, without necessarily having the answer to this, I wonder if part of addressing the more difficult issue is to focus in the first instance on when, as a matter of fact, you have a liability, because then perhaps once you've decided that you've got a liability, the question of what to do with the debit side is a little bit clearer, and perhaps it's helpful to separate those two things out. And perhaps the last thing I'd say on those issue 5 type questions, the one with the threshold, one of the things I've learned over the last year dealing with IFRIC 21 is perhaps here and in the US we might approach some of those questions in a slightly different way, in particular in the context of interim financial statements, and because of underlying differences in the way we think about interims, perhaps we will find legitimate differences in the way we account for some of these more complex commissions.
Thanks, Brian. Tony?
Some very similar thoughts to Brian. I think maybe to answer the question that Stuart posed up front is, do I disagree? No, I don't disagree. I think there's a couple of principles that are pretty clear in the standard around the requirement to capitalise the incremental cost of obtaining a contract and the requirement to amortise that over the expected pattern of transfer, taking into account, in some cases, anticipated future contracts. And my sense is that those principles provide enough background to be able to answer all of the questions that were posed in the paper. And so for that reason, I don't disagree with where Stuart got to, that I don't think there is any need to do anything further here. I think the principles can be applied. I'd probably build on what Brian said and go a step further than Stuart did around the steps in the process. And I do think every time step one is going to be, do I have a debit to account for? And I think it's the liability standard that will tell me whether I've got a debit to account for. So, for example, in connection with the more complicated question, if those are employee benefits, then I think IAS 19 is probably going to tell me when I ought to be recognising the obligation to pay the employees, and then IFRS 15 is going to tell me whether or not I can put that on the balance sheet. And so there's therefore a range of different IFRSs that might give us the answer to when the liability gets recognised, and then we can look to IFRS 15 to determine whether or not the debit goes onto the balance sheet. And I think IFRS 2 might be relevant, IAS 32 might be relevant, IAS 19, IAS 37, IFRIC 21 might all be relevant to that question. And for that reason, similar to Brian, I can see how that might give a different answer in the US if there's a difference in the liability standards.
But that difference is because of your assessment about exactly when am I, under this more complex commission arrangement, when am I triggering my obligation for that commission, which, as you say, is a difficult assessment. And you have to look also at the terms and conditions, obviously, of the plan.
And there's going to be judgment involved in when do I book the liability. There's going to be judgment involved in determining the pattern of transfer that will determine the amortisation profile. But I think the principles are clear enough. I guess the one last thing I would say is, and it's probably one for the ISB to at least bear in mind, is the ISB still has an open question around variable consideration for PP&E and intangible assets. And I wonder whether there is a crossover between whether or not you recognise a liability for contracts that may arise in the future, or at least the implications for potentially recognising an additional liability of the work that is going on to think about variable consideration for acquiring intangibles or service concessions and so on.
Okay. Any other thoughts? Yes.
Just two thoughts. One of them I think is minor, one of them slightly less minor. I do basically agree with what's said in the paper, and I basically agree with what Brian and Tony have just said as well. The more minor one I think is around issues 3 and 4. The drafting there, I just wasn't certain whether, because it was dealing with some relatively straightforward situations, and in particular it was assuming that if you have a contract that the customer is committed to everything in the contract and therefore everything's going to get delivered, and so you should do your accounting based on that. Obviously we have scenarios with sales of rights of return where we might see that actually roughly 10% of things come back perhaps quite consistently. We might also have commissions payable based on the things that don't get returned rather than everything. And I guess prior to reading this paper, I had assumed that the commission accounting would be based on the 90%, not the 100%. When I looked at the words in the paper, I wondered if the suggestion was that actually you should book it on the 100%, even though that's not your expectation. So I think that was as much as anything else about the way the paper was set out, and I wasn't sure if that had been considered. But it might give an impression that's out of line with where I thought I was. The bigger question for me is probably around issue 7 and amortisation and exactly how much scope there is there to try to capture what I might like to think of as the economics of an arrangement in terms of amortisation, because I think one very black and white way of approaching this is to say it's a very simple rule, you just amortise in proportion to expected revenues, irrespective of associated profitability, irrespective of how you'd actually structured your commission payments. I think you can have other situations in which the various elements of the contract have actually triggered their own individual commission payments, which much better captures the economics of what's going on. And I'm not really clear under issue 7 whether it is possible to amortise in a way that captures that, or whether that's not really allowed. So I wonder if there is more to think about there.
Okay, thank you. Any further? Mary.
Question, in light of a couple of the comments that have been made, both Tony and Brian brought out the point, and I think, Phil, you reinforced it, that you look to other standards to determine when you are recognizing a liability, and then once you have made that determination, think about applying IFRS 15. Is there an implicit message in what you're saying, or is there any confusion that IFRS 15 might override and impact the timing of recognition of costs, and that this discussion, I think this paper and that discussion, goes some way to addressing that? It's a thought that occurred as I listened to your comments, because I think some of the possible views that were raised, but I think dismissed in the paper by the staff, would have in essence accrued liabilities to calculate the amortization in a way that might not be consistent with the relevant liability standard. So perhaps there's also a clear message coming out of this that 15 only applies in terms of treating the recognized cost, and it does not override any of the liability recognition standards?
My initial reaction, Mary, on reading the paper was I wondered if in one or two instances it did drift into that territory. Mm-hmm. But I think I observed what Stuart said as he was introducing it. I think he referred specifically to thinking about the relevant standard that would trigger the recognition of the obligation. Mm-hmm. And so I think perhaps it wasn't meant to be a coded message, but I do think it's the relevant liability standard that will drive when you recognize the debit and how you measure it. And then it's this standard that will tell you what to do with it after that. Okay. And I don't think IFRS 15 should be thought of as overriding IAS 19 or IFRS 2.
I just think that some of the views that were laid out, reported to us as having been expressed as possible readings, might have required that kind of override, and that may be why it was occurring to you.
Okay. All right, Jim, over to you.
Thanks, Ian. Building on that discussion, do people here see the standard the same way that is other literature would govern potentially when you have an obligation that you now need to figure out what do I do with the debit side, and so that the revenue standard wasn't intending to address that? So if people agree with that, and then other comments on the paper.
Hey, Jim, could I just clarify, just in case that wasn't coming through clearly, in paragraph 41, that was more or less the intent of the staff when we were drafting this, was in recognition that this is a revenue recognition transition resource group, our intent was not to try and prescribe in this paper or delve into interpretive waters about when you should record that accrual. What we were more or less trying to get at in, you know, for example, paragraph 41, which then applies through, you know, a number of these examples, is the point that if you are recording an accrual, that's more or less when we're trying to figure out what your debit is. So I think it's been characterized accurately, and I just want to make sure that, you know, you have appropriate picture of what the staff were trying to do and what we were not trying to do. What we were not trying to do was interpret U.S. or international accrual or liability guidance, but we were trying to point out what we think is appropriate if you have decided under that other guidance that you should be accruing a liability. What do you do with that debit that probably makes the most sense? So that is consistent with what we heard, but I just want to make sure that you understand that was, in fact, the staff's intent here, whether it came through as clearly or not.
Allison?
Thanks, Jim. So I think it's really interesting whenever we go out to give trainings and to talk to companies, some of the most significant number of questions that we receive is on this topic, which I think might be reflective of what many might perceive as just this laundry list of detailed questions coming in. And as I thought to myself, well, why is that the case here in the U.S.? And I think it's because certainly under today's GAAP, we have a policy election that people can expense versus capitalize. So even companies that are capitalizing are asking questions, well, is what we're doing today under our current capitalization policy, will that continue to be appropriate? Because even if you determine that you're going to capitalize, you have one of two different ways under current US GAAP to get there. Under an analogy to ASC 310 related to loan origination costs, which allows you to be capitalizing internal costs related to the origination activities, or you can do an analogy to 605.20 and be capitalizing more just kind of direct and incremental costs. So some have looked at the standard and thought that the new guidance in 340.40 seems more consistent with 605.20 because of this reference to you only capitalize the costs that are incremental to actually obtaining the contract. But interestingly, the new standard doesn't actually refer to direct costs, whereas 605.20 today does refer to capitalizing direct and incremental costs. So that is one source of the confusion, and you can see that coming through in some of the questions that were outlined. And in appreciating very much the direction that the staff has provided in the papers, and I think that that is helpful. But I've observed that there have been some comments made that the principles are clear. And as our team was taking a look at this, we thought to ourselves, well, what is the principle for capitalizing the costs? And what I mean by that is if you're looking at example one, for instance, when you're talking about capitalizing renewals, the guidance that the staff thinks is the right way to apply the standard is to say, well, you anticipate renewals, but you only capitalize the cost for the original contract at the date of inception of that arrangement, and you don't anticipate future renewals. You only capitalize those costs once the option is actually exercised by the customer and they decide to renew the arrangement. Okay, fine. So no estimating. It seems to be saying in that example that the principle is you just think about one contract at a time, that future renewals are separate contracts. Well, what if that separate contract or that renewal was a material right? Does that change the analysis a little bit? So that's one question. And then moving forward, later on in the paper, it seems to contradict a bit when you get to issue number 5, where that's the example of the tiered commission structure, where in that fact pattern, okay, remembering what we just said, issue 1, don't estimate, think of future renewals as being something that's separate. But then when you get to issue 5, the staff view seems to be that, well, you should estimate, or you potentially that's an acceptable view, that you could estimate future contracts that might be obtained and that you would estimate and again, think about future contracts that have not yet actually been originated yet. So there seems to be a little bit of an inconsistency in terms of, well, when do you think of a renewal or additional contracts separately? And so you should think about the origination costs separately from those, and when do you not? That's the confusion. Like we look at this and think, well, what is the principle?
Does GAAP address that today?
I'm not sure that it directly addresses it.
So it's not necessarily this. You talked about three different methods. Mm-hmm. I guess the only one that would address it today would be expense all costs, so then you wouldn't have to deal with it, which some here have observed that if this is going to be such a challenging issue that maybe we ought to rethink the issue of expensing costs as incurred as opposed to capitalizing them. In all seriousness, if this is the level of detail we need to get into, I thought maybe the difference in the examples was the staff was sort of saying, follow, if you will, comp literature. I think comp literature in the fifth example would tell you if you have a commission that's payable on the 100th item that you wouldn't wait to the 100th item to begin recognizing that. And I think saying that that's probably the incremental cost, if you will, of each is how you get there. I'm not sure what comp literature would say if you have a bonus that's payable upon a renewal that isn't linked to prior transactions, would you begin accrual prior to that transaction? Take your point that there could be some interrelationship, but I think people would have to deal with that to figure out the liability side of the accounting in any case. But
well, I think it's interesting, Jim, just if I could follow up just real quickly. I think it's interesting you mentioned the comp literature. One fact pattern that isn't addressed here that I have heard coming up in practice is that oftentimes the payment of commission is linked to continuing employment on the part of the person that sold the commission. And so the guidance in here saying for clawbacks that you would potentially ignore those, I think a question has come up, well, what if it's linked to future employment? Under today's practice, people view that as being more akin to a stay bonus as opposed to being a cost to obtain a contract, and would like to think that the similar guidance would apply. And if that's not the case, it would be helpful to get that articulated today, I think.
Scott? I'm just going to reiterate. I mean, Allison's question is one that came up as I was looking at this. And I think in my head, I kind of saw the same potential inconsistency in the way renewals are supposed to be thought of and then the way additional contracts are laid out as possible thinking. Frankly, I ignored it all in my head and just said, no, the answer actually is when do I accrue the commission? If I accrue the commission, then I got to take it into account on the cost side of this. So, for example, on renewals, I have certainly seen companies using a policy under U.S. GAAP today that says if the renewal is absolutely expected, right? Historically, you get 95% renewals, they'll book the liability for that commission up front, even though the renewal hasn't happened. I don't think anything in this standard changes when you book that liability. And so if I thought it was acceptable before, then I think it's acceptable under the new literature, and then you'd have to deal with the cost, because now you, I think to use the words Tony used earlier, now you have a debit to account for. And if it is an incremental cost, which I think it would be, then you deal with it under the standard. So perhaps these examples are written in an overly presumptive way, as if we know exactly when every company is going to decide the liability for the commission gets booked. But I think if we kind of ignore exactly the way the examples are written, I do think the principle is you have a cost to deal with when you have a debit to book. And your question is, do I expense it or capitalize it? You don't need to think ahead to capitalize costs that you haven't yet incurred.
Brett, then Brian.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of great questions in this paper. You know, we could debate them. I think, and the staff's solutions make sense in most of them, frankly. I do think there is a risk, though, and I think the way it's been described, the way that Scott teed it up, makes perfect sense to me, that I have to first figure out what it is I'm accruing, and that's going to then give me some information as to what I do with the debit and whether it's capitalizable or not. So I think that is the gating issue that we should be focusing on. It, and it could be different. I mean, what people see as the obligating event, for example, for third-party commissions not paid to employee might be different than an employee commission. So I think there's a great risk of saying too much here, and this particularly in the context of a revenue standard in this TRG group. Like what we resolve here might be helpful, but it might be better to describe it as, you know, these are possible ways of approaching the issue, because I think there's so many scenarios, so many permutations on how these things might work in practice. The commissions might be payable on in a multiple element arrangement. It could be that the commission's payable on one aspect of it, and would you want to tell a company you can't look just that one aspect to amortize? And if you know, in some cases maybe it makes sense, some cases maybe it doesn't. So I'm not so sure it's we should be terribly prescriptive here. And I think the point that was raised before on the IFRS side here, I think it was example seven. I mean, it struck me that I might be a company who's looking to my profitability to determine my amortization period, and I don't think the standard would say that's wrong. So you know, while the three choices there, I think the staff rules out choice C, which was waiting to the last performance obligation. I'm not so sure the first two make sense to me, but I'm not so sure I would limit it to those first two. So maybe as we think about how we capture this issue, it might be good to just make sure we're not sort of limiting the choices here that might be reasonable.
Brian?
Maybe to dovetail a little bit off what Allison and Scott said, when I read this paper, there were
there were some that just the outcome strike me as a little bit curious. In, I think there's one example in 1B where one of the alternatives, the outcome would be that there would be the least amount of expense in the initial contract year. When, if I think about business, the most important and most valuable contract that you get is that first contract. And the renewals, you know, tend to come, but yet the accounting is resulting, and it kind of reminded me a little bit of back in the day in my youth, there was a SEC enforcement case where somebody did something, you know, amortized something on reverse sum of the year's digits. And it kind of struck me just as kind of a curious outcome in that saying that that's, you know, good accounting in the staff paper just struck me as a little bit odd.
So I'm sort of hearing, as it relates to the specific examples, potentially less is more, but do people disagree? And I think Tony maybe said it first, and several here have reiterated it, that the principle might be clearer if you think about following the literature that governs when you have a cost to recognize. And then, so if you're under literature, it says begin recognizing the cost, or in some cases there will be judgment in that literature, but we're dealing with this when there is a cost to recognize, and that's the principle we ought to make clear. People on the phone?
Hi, it's James Luke here. Without belaboring the point at all, I mean, a lot of my comments have been raised in the US and the UK. And I would like to support very much. I look at all my comments I've got next to the paper. Every question I've asked is always related back to the liability and whether there is an actual cost to have been recognized. And then once we've established that the liability is in existence, does that cost qualify for capitalization under IFRS 15? And I hear what the staff were saying earlier on, but it wasn't obvious to me when I read the paper that was the approach that was being used. I think I also flagged issue 7 as a possible issue, which I think is very judgmental. I don't think the standard is prescriptive, but the principle is there as to when you amortize, how you amortize these costs. And I think there's very little to be added to the standard. I think we can actually work out what costs should go in and how to amortize those costs. To me, what could be helpful would be that link to the cost should have been recognized under a liability standard and then deal with the cost under IFRS 15.
Okay, Jim, if there's no more comments from the phone, I agree with your broad summing up that this topic doesn't seem to call for great changes or any changes in the standard. But if you follow through the liability route to establish and then work out what you're going to do with the debit. And I think the other point is we need to look a bit carefully at the examples, because they can be a little cut and dried, and maybe less might be more in this particular case. Now,